Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Whenever we discuss grammar or usage or word origins on this show, the phones light up and our email folder is filled right away. Those who love language often pride themselves in building sizable vocabularies and wielding them to great effect. So it's strangely thrilling to discover how much we reveal about ourselves through the words most of us never think twice about, utilitarian function words like prepositions, pronouns, and articles. But through meticulous computer-assisted analysis, my guest has discovered that the way we use these words can say more than we ever intended about how we feel about ourselves and how we relate to the people around us. James Pennebaker is Regents Centennial Professor of Liberal Arts in the Psychology Department of the University of Texas at Austin and author of the 2011 book, The Secret Life of Pronouns, What Our Words Say About Us. He'll be in town Saturday to teach a one-day university class on the subject. You can find details there at onedayu.com. Jamie, welcome back to Think.
It's good to be back.
You make the point here that these function words are the most common ones in virtually every language. There are so few in every language, and we use them so often that most people could learn them in any language in an afternoon. How did you come to realize there was something special about this small group of very frequently used words?
Well, much like all of my research, I stumbled into it. I backed into it without any awareness of what I was doing. Several years ago, I was trying to understand how people use language when they were writing about emotional upheavals, and I needed some kind of word counting program that would go through and tell me how people were using words, and I couldn't find one. So working with Martha Francis, who was a graduate student with me at the time, we built a computer program that would go through and just calculate the percentage of words that were emotion words and certain types of thinking words. And as long as you're doing this, it was just as easy to throw in parts of speech like pronouns and prepositions and articles, conjunctions, and so forth. And then over the next few days, then weeks and months and now years, I hate to say decades now, what I started to notice was that it was these little junk words that I hadn't paid any attention to that were related to everything I was studying. And it started off was looking at the difference between men and women. And I found out that men and women use language very, very differently. They, you know, in terms of what they talked about, very often it would be the same, but how they were speaking was tremendously different in terms of these little invisible words.
Give us some examples of what's different between women and men.
Well, and I want to preface this by, this is not true with all men and all women, but these are statistical differences. And here, this is what lured me, because every study I did or every sample I looked at, I got results that made no sense. So the very first time I did an analysis between a group of men versus women, I found that women use the word I much more than men. And I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Everybody knows men are more arrogant and self-centered than women. But then as I got more and more deeply into it, it was true. Women use the word I at much higher rates. And I started to realize that the word I and its usage does not mean you're arrogant. In fact, it means just the opposite. It means that you're self-focused, that you are looking inward, and that people who are more self-focused, self-aware, use the word I much more than people who aren't. And that, in fact, men may, in fact, be more arrogant and confident. But people who are arrogant and confident use the word I much, much less. Just the opposite of what we naturally think is true. I found big differences in article use, a, an, and the. And I'm sure many people in the audience are thinking, this poor guy, what in the world? Who cares? I mean, my God, if my high school teacher knew that I was studying articles with excitement, first of all, she would have thought that I'd gone insane, and which might be true. But what it turns out is articles are interesting because you only use articles, a, n, and the, when you are going to use a noun, and specifically a concrete noun. The chair or a chair, the table, and so forth. And it turns out men use articles at much higher rates than women, partly because males tend to be focusing on objects and things more than women are. Women are talking more about people. Women, it turns out, use all pronouns or most pronouns more than men do. And the differences between men and women just went on from there. And they were suggesting in general, women are in fact really interested in human relationships. And men are, they're not that interested compared to women. And men are really interested in objects and things and how they work. And so this was really kind of the beginning of my discovery about these little words are telling us a lot more than anybody had ever thought. And it's interesting. Now I look at this and it's so obvious. Why didn't people discover this before? And the reason was we didn't have computers. These differences, say, in I word usage, if we get a large group of men and a large group of women and we just tape record what they're saying, we'll find on average women might use 8% of their words in conversations might be the word I, and for men it would be only 6%. Now, the difference between 8 and 6% from a statistical perspective is huge, is giant. But we as humans can't hear it. That's a really subtle difference. So I think that's one reason none of us ever caught on before the advent of computers.
So you need big data to really notice these patterns.
You don't need that big data, but you do need computers. So you need to have a methodology. It's much like you don't need a giant microscope to see an amoeba, but you need a microscope.
All right, let's listen to a film clip here. This is from a movie called Lost in Translation by Sofia Coppola. We'll hear Bill Murray as Bob and Scarlett Johansson as Charlotte. And we'll just see if people sound like women or men. We have a woman and a man in the scene. Let's just listen here.
Does it get easier?
No. Yes. It gets easier.
Oh, yeah? Look at you.
Thanks. The more you know who you are and what you want, the less you let things upset you.
Yeah. I just don't know what I'm supposed to be. You know? I tried being a writer, but I hate what I write.
You'll figure that out, and I'm not worried about you.
This is a movie, Lost in Translation, where, Jamie, you've said that both the female and the male leads talk like women.
I did. I trust you. It's interesting in this. I should tell you, by the way, even though I am a world expert on pronouns and function words, it's almost impossible to hear these words very well. Hmm. Our brains just aren't set up for it. In this snippet that you had, however, Murray actually does talk more like a male. He only used the word I once in that. And he used it. There's a technique that often happens where he was saying, he was essentially talking about himself. Well, you know, when you are doing this, you feel this way. Which is, most women would probably say, when this happens to me, I feel this way. So the way he was speaking was a kind of a distancing method. But it is true. He was using pronouns at probably slightly higher rates than the average male does. There's another interesting feature to this. In that movie, one thing that's interesting about Bill Murray's character, and you can just hear it in his voice, he's depressed. When people are depressed, they talk differently than when they're not depressed. And again, it's revealed through these function words. So a person who is depressed is self-focused. They tend to use the word I at higher rates than when they're not depressed.
When we hear I, by the way, one thing this technology demonstrated was that I is like the most frequently used word in the English language, which alone should validate the need to keep studying what the word means to us. but there's a question of power, which is very interesting. People who are lower, perceive themselves to be lower on the sort of social hierarchy, are more likely to say I and refer to themselves specifically. And people who are higher on the social hierarchy and recognize that are less likely to use the word I. What's that about?
I've always thought of it as a little bit like two dogs. So when you're in the park and you see two dogs, you can pretty quickly figure out who's the higher status dog if they don't have a fight to establish that the hierarchy. The high status dog stands there looking around the world, and here comes the lower status dog who's coming and cowering, rolling over, exposing his or her belly. And you can almost see what the two are paying attention to. The big dominant dog is looking around the world saying, "Ah, it's great to be alive. Look at this little sniveling person." And the other one is, "Oh, don't bite me, don't hurt me." And is feeling anxious and looking inward. And I think that's part of this. When we're in situations, the high status person is looking around the environment much more broadly, and the lower status person is looking more, they're anxious, they're looking more internally. And I think that's reflected in what we see with language. What's interesting about this is we all switch from interaction to interaction. So I can be in an interaction where I'm talking to one person who is lower status, and I'll ask them how they're doing or whatever. And they will use I in talking to me, but I won't much with them. And it's the same when I'm talking with someone of higher status. In fact, I started to do some of this research, and I was doing it with emails, and I had found this difference between high and low status, and I thought, I wonder if that's true of me in my emails. And I went, and I was horrified how much it came out. And it came out in an interesting way. So if an undergraduate student wrote me, the student might write, "Dear Dr. Pennebaker, I am so-and-so, and I was wondering if I could ask you some questions because I'm curious about such-and-such." And I would write back to the student, "Dear student, thank you so much for your email. Your ideas sound interesting. How about coming by the office tomorrow at such-and-such?" And then I look at my email to the dean. Dear Dean, I don't know if you remember, but I am Jamie Pennebaker, and I'd like to ask some questions about such and such." And the dean would write back, "Dear Jamie, thank you so much for your email. It's always good to hear from you. How about we meet tomorrow?" Now, it's fascinating how we all kind of flip from one role to another. And what's interesting is this is the language of power, but it's not. Nobody's putting anybody down. In fact, in both these cases, the high status person is being very respectful of the lower status person. It's a warm relationship. Neither person would be offended by that interaction, but it's the language of power, and which I find fascinating how this just kind of bubbles up everywhere. In fact, we've analyzed old plays and books written in ancient Greece in Greek. But in 500 BC, we've looked at manuscripts from China, from around the world, and this seems to be a universal phenomenon that across language, across cultures, across time, higher status people use the word I less.
My guest is James Pennebaker, Regents Centennial Professor of Liberal Arts in the Psychology Department at the University of Texas at Austin. He'll be in town Saturday to teach a one-day university class on what word usage can reveal. That will take place at the Renaissance Hotel in Dallas. You can find information at onedayu.com. His book, published in 2011, is called The Secret Life of Pronouns, What Our Words Say About Us. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I'm also on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
Butt bellies are sexy.
Well, you should be happy. Because you have one.
Shut up, fatso. I don't have a butt.
I have a bit of a tummy.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard Bruce Willis and Maria de Medeiros in Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction, where both male and female leads talk like men. May not be evident in that clip. We won't go into it, but you can rent the movie and listen for it again. My guest is James Fenwaker, author of a book called The Secret Life of Pronouns, What Our Words Say About Us. He'll be in town Saturday to teach a one-day university class. All right, Jamie, I want to talk about another fascinating word, and that is the word we. It can go both ways, right? It can be like warm and inclusive, and that's how a lot of us think about it when we use it, but it can also indicate a kind of shirking of personal responsibility, like the half of we that is you needs to go do this thing.
That's right. It's one of these words that is just so much fun to analyze, because I think the culture, I certainly believed that when anybody used we, they're trying to be inclusive, they're trying to be warm, they're trying to care. And in fact, when you look at the difference between men and women and the use of we, it turns out they're exactly the same, which makes no sense at all. Until you look a little bit more carefully at it. Basically, usually when women use the word we, they really are being more inclusive. You know, you and I, let's go to the store. We'd have a good time at the store. Men tend to use we in a more psychologically distancing way, which is the way that I sometimes talk to my students. So they'll be in my office and I'll say, you know, we need to analyze this data. Now, that doesn't mean my students and I need to hold hands and go analyze this data. It means, hey, guys, you need to go analyze the data. That what I'm doing is using we as a kind of what I would view as a polite way of saying you. So I'm not so cold to say you need to analyze the data. I'm saying we need to analyze the data. And it's really fun listening to politicians in their use of we. Because sometimes their use of we is, you have no idea who the we is. And the more they're using ambiguous we words, the less you can trust them. And what I love about it is that very often political consultants don't know this. So years ago when Kerry was running against George Bush, Kerry, as you might remember, was a bit of a stick. He just couldn't warm to humans. And if you analyze his now you know, maybe other species, but it wasn't working well. And if you had analyzed, as we did, analyze the language of Bush versus Kerry, Bush used I at much, much higher rates than did Kerry. And part of this is Bush is a much, he came across as a much more warmer, more authentic person. So I read in the New York Times that Kerry's advisors were aware that he was cold, and what they advised him was he needed to start using the word we more. And I heard that and I thought, well, he's dead. Because he was already using we at least twice as much as Bush was, and we is associated with being more distant, and his advisors, who, by the way, were a very smart group of people, were now telling him, you know, you're not being cold and distanced enough. See if you can push it up a little bit more by using we more. And this, to me, is kind of the beauty of these words, which is we all have these theories of how they work, but our theories are almost always wrong. And as a psychologist, there's nothing of greater joy than finding that the culture has certain beliefs that are wrong.
You know, it is kind of, it's exciting for me too as a journalist. It's just fun to discover that what you were sure was definitely true may not be true.
All right. That's really true.
Let's listen here. This is President Obama addressing the nation in May of 2011 after Osama bin Laden was killed.
Over the last 10 years, thanks to the tireless and heroic work of our military and our counterterrorism professionals, we've made great strides in that effort. We've disrupted terrorist attacks and strengthened our homeland defense. In Afghanistan, we removed the Taliban government, which had given bin Laden and al-Qaeda safe haven and support. And around the globe, we worked with our friends and allies to capture or kill scores of al-Qaeda terrorists, including several who were a part of the 9/11 plot.
Victor Davis Hanson of the National Review pointed out after that speech that the president used the word I, me, or my in the 1,400-word speech 15 times and said with that count that Obama was personalizing the presidency. I'm guessing that you might disagree with the word count and what it says.
That's so great. I just love this. And I should say, both the Democrats and Republicans, because they don't talk to each other and they hate each other's guts, say the same thing about each other all the time.
Uh-huh.
Many people, if you're a born-again Republican and you think everything that Obama does is horrible and terrible, you immediately buy into the fact that he uses the word I all the time. He uses I less than any modern American president by a lot. It is stunning how rarely he does it. If he used the word I 15 times in that speech, percentage-wise, that would probably be one – that would probably be at least it would be 200% less than what the average president would have said. And in fact, Obama's speech patterns are really interesting. He is really psychologically cool. He's really distant. He uses I hardly at all. He doesn't use emotion words much at all. He uses really high rates of cognitive words. He's very cerebral in the way that he talks, but he's also emotionally distant. Very, very different from George Bush. Very, very different from Clinton. This is what's so intriguing about this is you can get a good sense of someone by the way they're using words, not once they become president, but before they become president. All of these people I just mentioned spoke very similarly before they were elected. These are kind of markers of the way people are.
Is there any real point in analyzing speeches that have been written out for people to read? I mean, those are not the same as extemporaneous speech that presumably would reveal something about our inner psychological state.
That's true. But a good leader puts his or her stamp on most speeches because they want it to reflect who they are. And that's another thing. I've spent some time with some of the top speechwriters, and what's interesting about these speechwriters is they spend time with whoever they're writing the speeches for. They're trying to get inside that person's head and to talk like that person. So what I found in my work is that very often if I look at a president's speeches and compare it with the president's use of language within press conferences, it's by and large really similar. But you're right. If there's some leader who is not, in fact, writing their own speeches, that's true. That would be much less trustworthy. But that's why, actually, I far prefer press conferences. Press conferences are glorious for a data analyst like myself.
Will you have the linguistic inquiry and word count computer fired up for the Republican debate?
Yes, I will. it's already running in the background, just waiting for the words to pour out.
I know that this is off the cuff, but having listened just casually to someone like Donald Trump, or maybe you've actually looked at him, it seems to me that he doesn't speak like any other politician that I have encountered on the national stage in the United States. And do you want to take a stab at what that?
Well, my group and I have, in fact, had some delicious fun already analyzing the last Republican debate. I loved it. It was a great debate, just in the sense that it was very revealing about the people, and the language that people were using was really quite different. I'll give you a couple of dimensions that are particularly interesting. One of them is I'm particularly interested in people's language of dominance and power, and there's two ways of looking at this. One is the way that we were just talking a few minutes ago, where the person who's high status doesn't use I, and the low status person uses I more. And with Trump, he's above average. He's got a lot of clout. He's not as extreme as, say, Obama, but he's in the top half, I would say. Cruz would be there, and some others. The ones this another kind of dominance is the degree to which people are paying attention to dominance. Hmm. So when you walk into a room, to what degree are you sizing other people up? Do you make references to people who are higher or lower status? Trump was by far the lowest in that entire group. He didn't pay attention to anybody's status. Partly, I suppose, that he feels that he's the top dog, but he doesn't care about anybody else's status. And the person who cared about other people's status the most by far was Ted Cruz. So when Cruz walks into the room, he is immediately sizing everybody up in terms of relative status. So that's one issue. Another issue that I've been looking a lot at in the last few years has been something that we are calling analytic thinking. This came about through analysis of things like students' admissions essays to college, and that people who write and use language where they're using lots of prepositions in articles and really low rates of things like pronouns, they tend to be more psychologically distant, but they also are more formal in their thinking. And the person who's – so Cruz was actually very high in this analytic thinking, very informal thinking, and there were some others that were in that. The person who was by far the lowest, Trump. Trump talks as though he's not very smart. Now, I think he is smart, but he's not a formal, logical thinker. He – and duh. He shoots from the hip. He doesn't analyze problems deeply and thoroughly, and it comes through in his language.
I love that you turn this this technique around on yourself, probably before you go to anybody else. You looked back at some letters of recommendation that you've been asked to write for graduate students over the years. This is something professors have to do. And I gather that unless the student has been just a colossal failure, you feel an obligation to say something nice. But you feel genuinely excited about the prospects of some students and maybe more measured about the prospects of others. What was different in the two kinds of letters?
Well, first of all, many of us out there write letters of recommendation, or we read lots of letters of recommendation. Hmm. And if you read lots of letters of recommendation, you know, you're trying to decode. Right. What does this letter writer really think about the person? Because everybody's, you know, they want to say something nice. And so you're right. I thought, well, at least one person I can trust is myself. So I had access to several hundred letters I've written over the last many years. And I just went down the list in terms of what do I really think of this person? And then I analyzed the letters, and I was actually quite surprised. Isn't it funny? I was shocked in terms of how I was revealing myself. The first thing I discovered was the people that I liked the most, I tended to use very few positive emotion words about. Well, that's weird. So I didn't say they're wonderful, they're great, and so forth. I didn't have to, because instead I came up with examples. This person does this. Let me give you an example of what this person did in this situation. Whereas the person who I didn't know very well or didn't think that highly of, I'd say, this person's really good, you know, really seems to be smart and is seems to be happy, whatever. It was more kind of hand-waving. I was more specific in the people that I was really high on. And ironically, a lot of this is what we find in honesty. When people are being honest, they tend to be less positive. They tend to be more specific. They also tend to use the word I a little bit more. And that general pattern was true in terms of letters of recommendation, at least for me.
It's fascinating, Jamie, that so many of us feel as if we can tell when someone is lying, and typically we're pretty bad at picking out the liars. Why is it so hard for us when, you know, presumably a lot of people tell lies, and you would think that you could recognize patterns from your own deceptions?
Yeah, it's fascinating how difficult it is. You know, part of it is we all have these certain theories. And the problem is they're never tested. So you'll talk to somebody and afterwards you'll say, okay, that person was lying. But you never go back and actually find out, were they actually lying? Or sometimes you'll call them on it, and they'll say, oh, no, I was not lying. Look at this and this and this, and you'll be convinced, and you'll think that your perception was wrong, when in fact they probably were lying. So I think that's the problem. And the data is really quite compelling. If you look at interviews, you induce people to lie or tell the truth, and you give transcripts, people are lousy. They do just a little bit better than chance at estimating if someone's lying or telling the truth. And this is a problem for people doing interrogation, with the police, with the FBI, with polygraphers. These are problems everywhere. And so, you know, obviously I became interested in this in terms of how we can use language to do that very thing. Is it possible to come up with some kind of linguistic lie detector?
Because there's no truth to the old saw that you're unable to look someone in the eye and tell a bald-faced lie. Lots of people are really good at that.
It's really easy to do that, especially if you've got to do it.
Mm-hmm. So the linguistic lie detector, is this, are there law enforcement agencies who are interested in this? Are there, you know, people interviewing individuals for jobs that are interested in this?
The answer is yes, but here's one thing that everyone needs to appreciate. All lie detector approaches are lousy. It's really important. So a polygraph, it's really good compared to chance, but it's still not very good. That's why it's not allowed in court. Ironically, it's probably better than many of the other things like eyewitness testimony, which is horrible. Linguistic lie detection? When we come back, I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Thank you for setting us up for the break. My guest is James Pennebaker, Regents Centennial Professor of Liberal Arts in the Psychology Department at UT, author of The Secret Life of Pronouns. He'll be in town on Saturday to teach a one-day university class on what word usage can reveal about us. That'll happen at the Renaissance Hotel in Dallas. If you'd like to join us, call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I am Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with James Pennebaker of UT Austin, where he is Regents Centennial Professor of Liberal Arts in the Psychology Department, and he's the author of the 2011 book, The Secret Life of Pronouns. On Saturday, he'll be in town to teach a one-day university class on what word usage can reveal about us. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Before we take some calls and emails, Jamie, caveats for the linguistic lie detector technology?
Well, we've done multiple studies, and there have now been dozens of studies. In fact, I was just at a small workshop of about 20 different researchers from around the world, and we brought together about 80 studies of using language to see if we can detect lies. And what we're discovering is that there's a pattern of word usage for some kind of lies, and there's another kind of language used for other types of lies. The kind of lies that I've generally dealt with have been more interrogation kind of lies. So we will have somebody do what we call a mock crime. We have them go to a room and give them the opportunity to steal a dollar versus not, and then we interrogate them. Or we have them write about something they truly believe or they truly don't believe as though they believed it and so forth. In those kind of parlor game kinds of lies, people are, when they are telling the truth, they tend to use the word I much more than when they're lying. They also tend to use more complex language. So they use words that are words like exclusive. These are words like except, but, without, not, words such as that. What they're doing is they're making a distinction between telling the truth, telling what they did do, but also what they didn't do. So the ability to say what you didn't do is something that we naturally can do when we're telling the truth. Well, I was going to go to the store, but instead I remembered I forgot this, so instead I did that. If you're lying, that's just way too complicated. You're already saying stuff you didn't do, and then to say what you thought about not doing and not doing it is just beyond human capabilities. So some of these linguistic dimensions are we do pretty well with. There are other kinds of lying, however. So, for example, people who write fake reviews for Travel Advisor, something like that, they use language completely differently than people who are telling the truth. So come back to me in about 5 years, and I will be able to tell you precisely which of these language patterns predict. How well do they predict? You know, they do a lot better than a human. So in our studies, we could catch somebody 66% of the time when 50% was chance, which is a lot better than humans. Humans, in reading transcripts, catch them about 53%, where 50% is chance. But if you want a lie detector catcher that's going to be 95% accurate, good luck. It doesn't exist. And if someone tries to sell you one of these,
it's a lie.
It's a lie. But I'll invest in that company.
All right, we have a tweet here from Ronald who asks, are politicians aware of the skills you speak of? And I think he means with regard to lying. What should we be listening for in tonight's debate?
Bad news, it's going to be really hard to hear because, again, our brains just can't do it. I always like to listen for we. And if they are using we a lot, ask yourself, who's the we? Are you part of that we? I also am always interested in how complex their thinking is. Are they making distinctions in ways that are valuable? To what degree are they emotional or not? Another one that I've become really interested in is use of references to males versus females. We have a new version of our computer program, Luke, LIWC. Which is going, this is shameless, but it's going up for sale in a couple of days. And what's interesting about it is we have this catcher for how often you make references to males versus females. And it's kind of a marker of sexism in the sense that some people never make references to the opposite sex. And some people make references at comparable rates. So, for example, in the last Republican debate, Rubio actually made slightly more references to females than males. Rand Paul did not make a reference to a female the entire time he spoke. So these are kind of markers of where people are paying attention. The way you use pronouns tells us where you are paying attention, what's important to you. So those are the things that I would probably... I actually won't listen for them, but I will analyze them, and that's when I'll pay attention to them.
All right, let's go to the phone. We have Robbie on the line in Plano. Hi, Robbie. Robbie, are you with us? Okay, we will move on. We have a question here from, let's see, this one comes from Don, who says, many leadership philosophies, such as servant leadership and authentic leadership, recommend the use of we instead of I as a manifestation of a humble, inclusive leadership mindset. How do you see this we philosophy intersecting with your pronoun research?
I would say that that philosophy is based on the false understanding of the way we is. Go in and analyze people who you view as really good leaders. I think you're going to find that a really good, caring leader does not use we a lot. So I would challenge that philosophy. I think the underlying idea is true, that being inclusive, caring, looking around at others, being empathic and so forth, those are really important goals for being a good leader. Using the word we, not so much.
Okay, so I don't know how you feel about the validity of this research, but it's come up on this show before that people who need to go into a situation and need to feel a little more self-confident can do what's been called like the Superman stance, which is where you sort of put your hands on your hips and you spread your legs out wide and you lift your head up high. And somehow standing that way and taking some deep breaths for a few seconds seems to help people gain emotional self-confidence just from standing that way and taking on that physical presence. Is there an equivalent in the way we use language? Can we think deliberately before something like a job interview or meeting new people at a party or chairing a PTA meeting?
This is a really interesting question. I think in terms of the stance approach, I think there's real validity to that for the first 30 seconds. And then once – but don't get me wrong. That first 30 seconds of the speech, the interview or whatever is really important because it's the first impression and it also sets you on a path for the rest of the interview. I do think that is important. Language is really different. First of all, having to pay attention to the words you're using is cognitively incredibly complex, which means you go and stand in front of the PTA group, and now you're paying attention to your pronoun use. You're going to sound like an idiot. We feel that the idea is do this in your mind. I send you into a room, and you're going to be with a group. And I say, okay, when you're in this group, I do not want you to use the word I at all. So when you talk, just don't use the word I. Now, what will happen is you can do that. And now the question I have is, do you think you'll now be the leader at the end of the meeting? And my guess is probably not. However, if I say, go into this group, and one thing I want you to do is try to emerge as the leader. Try to show leadership, you know, be aware of others and so forth. If you're successful, there's a good chance if I told you to do that, you would come away as the leader. And here's what's interesting, you will use I at very low rates. In other words, language reflects who we are. It doesn't drive who we are. And we've done multiple studies, my students and I have, where we manipulate, set it up so people use language differently, because like many others, I thought that if we could change people's language use, we could change their psychological states. It never worked.
We know there are many people in the world that might benefit from psychological or psychiatric help at certain times in their lives, but many of the same people are reluctant to go seek out help or to feel like they're being evaluated. Are there ways to use some of the analyses that you've mentioned to screen for things like, say, depression or post-traumatic stress in returning vets?
I think yes. And here would be my test. And again, we've done work like this. If you go back and you look at your email or your text messages, Facebook posts, and look at them over the last week or month or year. And go back and see, when was I depressed? Oh, yeah, I was depressed last February. And you go and you look at your emails during that time. In all likelihood, you will see an increase in your use of the word I. Or sometimes there'll be other kinds of changes. You can use these as markers for your behavior now. If you think that you may be getting depressed, go and look at your emails now. Have they changed in the last week or month or whatever? So you can use these as signals of your psychological state. So, yes, I think they can be used to some degree that way.
Analyzing text messages would seem to present some vexing challenges because even now that everybody has like a full QWERTY keyboard and you know, people under 30 can type just as fast as on a keyboard and a computer, we're still truncating those messages, right? Everybody's kind of still using shortcuts in most text messages.
Not a problem. In fact, much of the research my team and I are doing right now is with things like Twitter. Twitter is fabulous, by the way. I want everybody out there use lots of Twitter because we want to analyze it. Because, yes, we use shortcuts, but we can pick these up. So if the person's C U with the letter C, the letter U, it's real easy to train our computer to see those words as S-E-E and Y-O-U. And it's interesting, even with Twitter, when you don't have that many characters, people's use of the word I, for example, they're lower than they are with regular emails or something, but not that much lower. We find the same general patterns with tweets, with text messages, as we do with letters and emails.
There are people who say that they can predict how long relationships are going to last based on the way, I think it's John Gottman, right, based on the way that married partners refer to each other and interact in a room. Can you tell anything about romantic prospects by analyzing language?
This is one of my favorite projects. Working with a group of people, we analyzed two different data sets. One was a data set of speed dating, and so speed dates are wonderful from a social science perspective. Again, I encourage everybody to be involved in speed dating. And
if not already married.
If not already married. And what we would do is analyze the language of these people when they are in their speed dates. And then we would compare, we'd look to see, can we predict if they would date one another by the way that they are connecting? And we use a metric called language style matching, which is how similarly the two people speak. Net effect is we can predict who will go out on a subsequent date at rates higher than the people themselves because their language is matching. The other one was looking at young dating couples. Now, these were college students, by and large freshmen, so they're really unstable relationships. And again, from a science perspective, that's what we want. This kind of instability, we can predict it.
Right.
And we, to be in our study, they had to give us 10 days of instant messages that they sent back and forth. And what we found is the more similar they are in their instant messages, in their language use, the more likely they're going to be together 3 months later. So, for example, those who are the most connected in the top half, 80% were still together 3 months later, and those in the bottom half in terms of matching, language matching, only 50% were still together.
And when they don't match, is it like a long, flowery text and then a, sure, babe, see you later? Is that the mismatch?
There's some of that. And that's what was so interesting about it. When you go back and look at it, honestly, when I went back and looked at the data, I thought, geez, who would have ever thought this relationship would last? But what's so funny is the people themselves are convinced that they have a good relationship. And this self-delusion, I guess, is what has kept many of us going our whole lives in terms of just getting along in life. But what's interesting is those relationships that are not working, you can see that one or both are emotionally detached from the other.
James Pennebaker is Regent Centennial Professor of Liberal Arts at the Psychology Department at UT and author of the 2011 book, The Secret Life of Pronouns. He'll be in town Saturday to teach a one-day university class on the subject. Find details at onedayu.com. Jamie, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
You bet. This was fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.